Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
But I want to start with a bizarre, and I'll be honest with you, a shocking game. Felt like Toronto was going to win this series. Felt like the addition of Kawhi Leonard, who I think you can make an argument, second best player in the NBA when he's healthy. And Kawhi yesterday, an absolute machine in Philly against the Raptors. Or against, excuse me, the Sixers. 33 points, 13 of 22, incredible defensive energy. And yet a Sixers team that hasn't liked each other at times this year, that has the talented question mark that is Joel Embiid, and that felt overmatched, at least in the first game of the series, didn't just win. They dominated that game, 116-95. And Philly played great, there's no doubt. Jimmy Butler, 22 points. Every one of those starters in double figures. Embiid played like an MVP, but I was trying to figure out, what is it about Toronto that's not adding up? You have a team that made an Eastern Conference Finals Game 7 a few years ago against LeBron and the Cavs. You swap out in DeMar DeRozan, maybe the most popular Raptor of all time, but a guy without much of a jump shot. And you bring in Kawhi Leonard, not just almost 100 postseason games in his career, though that's true. Not just the second youngest NBA Finals MVP in the history of the game after Magic Johnson, but that's true. But a closer and a two-way player. And I think the answer, as it turns out, is that the Toronto Raptors, and I was trying to think of an argument against this earlier today, preparing for the program, preparing for the Jim Rome Show. Bill Rutter with you. The idea in my head that Kyle Lowry might be the worst postseason player in the history, at least, of the modern NBA. Last night, Lowry, who is the number two on that team. I know Pascal Siakam is the guy lately, played well in this postseason, was really good last night, recovered from some inefficient games, 7 of 15, 20 points. But Lowry's a guy that's been through the battles and been through the wars. Lowry's a guy that has failed in the postseason. That's supposed to, if you're a winner, if you've got what it takes, that can often be the catalyst for greatness. And instead, Kyle Lowry, and we're going to call him Kyle Lowry here on the show because he pulls his team low. Lowry undercut everything the Raptors are building. Think about the stakes and the pressure. Masai Ujiri, who's the president of operations in Toronto, traded away the most popular Raptor of all time for a one-year rental in Kawhi Leonard. Now, I don't think Kawhi Leonard's staying in Toronto even if they hoist that trophy. I don't. And a lot of people around the NBA don't think Kawhi Leonard is staying. But you lose to the Sixers in the second round of the NBA playoffs, and it's over. You're a Clippers fan, you're a Nets fan. Be cheering for Philadelphia. And be praying that Nick Nurse, the head coach, continues to put Kyle Lowry, bringing his team low, in that game. And afterwards, Lowry talked about the obvious, he's got to be better.
Me personally, I got to play better. I mean, I can't go out there and shoot 2 for 10 and, you know, miss open, you know, threes. But, yeah, we're getting good looks. You know, look at the film, see where we can get better looks. And they're really just everywhere over the floor. And we just got to, you know, start being executed a little bit better and, you know, making them pay for the randomness that they're doing.
Oh, Lowry's got to be better. Well, that solves it. Thanks, Kyle. That's really helpful. Kyle Lowry, and I like the guy, good dude, easy to root for, and he's subtraction the sum of all human joy in the postseason. Let me give you a few of his performances before last night. That 7-point dud, 5 points on 2 of 7 shooting when they were down to the Cavs 3-0 in last year's postseason. 11 points on 5 of 14 shooting in game 7 of the first round in 2016 versus the Pacers. In a Game 6 loss to Brooklyn back in 2014, 4 of 16. I'm a big believer that failure shapes success. And we've seen this before. We'll talk to Mitchell Trubisky about this in a minute. That heartbreaker for the Bears in this past postseason might be the fuel for a guy like Mitchell Trubisky and that Bears team to go to another level. Hell, Trubisky, Jared Goff, LeBron James in the finals all those years ago against the Mavericks. So many athletes' lowest moments, they will tell you, is a thing that reached them. where they, in LeBron's case, he has told me and other folks, literally turned off the lights, laid in a dark room, and let the humiliation and the failure wash over them. And came out of that room understanding, you know what? It doesn't get much worse. I'm going to hold on to that feeling. And I'm going to use it as the fire to make sure it never happens again. But some players get broken. Some players can't handle, and not just players, right? All of us in what we do can't handle the failure and the embarrassment. I know that Siakam is important to what the Raptors are about. I understand that a team that was one of the best defensive groups in the country needed to do a better job. But Kawhi Leonard is the second best player, the third best player in the NBA right now when he's healthy, when he's locked in, when he's not going through some ugly, weird private divorce with the San Antonio Spurs. And when you have the best player on the floor, when you have a guy that's shooting better than 60% in a postseason series, when you have a guy who's doing that and he's also the best defensive force in the National Basketball Association, when you've got Siakam contributing more, sometimes the problem is someone in your locker room, someone on the floor, is felling the very idea that you can win because he's infecting the team with his own doubt. And that's Lowry. All this talk about the Raptors and whether they should have traded DeRozan, and of course they should have. You got to go for it. I love the boldness of Masai Ujiri going for Kawhi Leonard. The problem is, and we've seen this in Game of Thrones, right? Game of Thrones fans? If you're going to go to war, if you're going to wipe somebody out, you wipe out the entire family. You don't leave anybody or any reminder of what was before. Kyle Lowry should have been on the next plane out after DeMar DeRozan. Trade him for a Skittles and a Snapple. You can go Kiwi, Strawberry, whatever flavor you want. Get him out of town. Because the guy's a loser. I know it's a harsh word. People are so sensitive today. We're talking about professional sports. We're talking about a world where literally these guys are measured by who wins and who loses. LeBron James, at least until the Lakers, winner. Kawhi Leonard, winner. Last night, Sixers, winner. You know what you are if you're the opposite of that? If you're a guy that can never get it done, you're a loser. I like Kyle Lowry. Interviewed him a few times in my beat writing days. Good dude. And utterly incapable of playing like even a shadow of the player that he used to be. Or yet he has been in the regular season. Kyle Lowry is a huge part of the problem. Because what the Sixers did last night, yeah, they had their star in Embiid. But the Raptors matched that. They had their star in Kawhi Leonard. Every single guy that played for Philly, every single guy contributed and played with confidence. Hell, Greg Monroe was efficient for the 30 seconds he got on the floor. At this stage, and the Eastern Conference playoffs are fascinating. We'll get into the other series, Milwaukee Celtics, later. I don't know if all of these teams can beat the Warriors. I think two of them can. But every one of the teams that remain are good enough if they play, not even the best version of their form of basketball. They hit 90% over a seven-game series of making the finals. But you are only as good when you're evenly matched as your weakest link. And Kyle Lowry is that link. It's not about the three-point shooting, although Lowry didn't help 0 for 4. It's not about the bench not helping the Raptors. They were a little bit better, actually, yesterday relative to what the Sixers bench did. It's about the fact that when you're facing a team with three or four stars, Jimmy Butler's star, Joel Embiid's star, Ben Simmons, and I don't think the box score tells the tale sometimes, athletic freak, especially when he plays downhill, certainly capable of being a star. Tobias Harris kind of in that gray area. You need more than Kawhi Leonard. How often have we talked about LeBron James, how he doesn't get help, didn't get help in L.A., didn't get help in Cleveland? Well, you know what? LeBron's not the only superstar in the modern NBA where stars cluster together who require some assistance. Toronto can still win this series, but it's going to require something we've only seen one time in his career, when nobody was really counting on the Raptors. And pressure doesn't feel like pressure when everyone thinks you're going to fail. This is about Kyle Lowry. There was a time when Lowry was an all-star. There was a time when people talked about Lowry as part of a rising, dominant backcourt in Toronto. There was a time when people believed Lowry could be a contributor. He's the third best player on that team, but he's the second most important. Kyle Lowry, you got to show up. Because DeMar DeRozan's gone. And if you, the last of the two great Raptors, don't start playing basketball like you belong there, Kawhi Leonard's going away. And the Raptors are never again, not in the near future, going to be anything resembling what they are now. And that's an actual contender. That's a lot of weight to put on one guy, but Lowry is considered, and I think he is, the second best, the second most important, the second soul of the Toronto Raptors. And the other guys, the San Antonio Spurs, probably golfing somewhere right now. Kyle Lowry, get it done.
I know how frustrating it can be, especially if you're in a hurry or you're running late. You find yourself at a railway crossing. You're waiting for the train. The signals are going and you can't even see the train. It's not there yet. So you feel tempted to try to sneak across the tracks. Don't do it. Terrible decision. Trains are often going a lot faster than you expect them to be. They cannot stop. Even if the engineer hits the brakes right away, it can still take a train over a mile to stop. By that time, what used to be your car is simply a crushed hunk of metal. What used to be you, what do you say we don't go there? The point is this. You can never know how quickly the train is going to arrive. The train can't stop even if it does see you. The result is the worst thing ever. If the signals are on, the train is on its way, and you need to remember only one thing. Stop. Stop, because the trains cannot.
Gone rogue, Mitchell Trubisky, Bears quarterback. Mitch, what's going on, man?
What's up? How's it going? Thanks for having me on.
Appreciate you. Thanks for being on the Jim Rome Show. Just talking about culture and just the significance of it. And you're a guy that's played under a couple head coaches in Chicago. And focusing on the guy that's the head coach now, can you speak to how important the things we don't see is to a quarterback success, to a team success, this idea of the culture that's created before you guys ever step on the field?
Yeah, it's incredibly important. Coach Nagy has done an amazing job setting the tone for our culture in Chicago. It really all starts with him, his attitude, his competitiveness, his passion for the game, his ability to unite people and build team chemistry really throughout our whole building. So our team has just gotten closer and closer since he stepped into the building. We play with a lot more confidence and swag, and we always have that edge, whether it's coming out to practice, heading into the weight room, or being locked in throughout meetings. And it all starts with the head man, and it trickles down to everyone throughout the building. And he sets the tone, and everyone's bought into that, and it's made this whole process so exciting, and everybody wants to be a part of it, and we just want to keep rolling, and we set our goals and expectations even higher this year, and then go chase them and get after it. And so that's the attitude, that's the culture in Chicago, and if you can't tell, I'm pretty amped about it, and that's just how it is.
Bears quarterback Mitch Trubisky here on the show. Mitch, Bears went up and got you in that draft. First year didn't go the way that a lot of folks wanted.
Mm-hmm.
We're in a society that criticizes people immediately. For you, what was the process of trying to understand it was going to take you some time to be the quarterback you wanted to be, even if you're playing and competing in a world where there is no patience and the scrutiny is, it comes fast and it comes sometimes unfairly?
Yeah, definitely. That's just part of the process, part of the business. Of professional sports, especially in the NFL, fans, the fan base, they expect immediate results. And as a player and competitor, you want immediate results too, but that's not always how it happens. So you just have to go in with that mindset that there's going to be growing pain, there's going to be adversity, but the positive mindset, the work ethic you bring day in and day out, how you treat people in your building, is all going to result in how you could turn around that culture and get things going in the direction that you want them to. So you really just got to take control of your career early on and embrace the down times and you just keep grinding and moving forward to get out of those low points. So it's not always going to be the way you want it to be early on in your career, but you just got to have a great support group. And for me, it's been my family, my incredible teammates and coaches, and just me believing in myself and my supporting cast believing in me too, just to keep going and pushing the envelope to get better and better.
Mitchell Trubisky here on the Jim Rome Show. Bill Ryder filling in. Mitch, it's almost certain at a certain point there's going to be criticism to Kyler Murray. Every guy that was drafted as a quarterback high in the NFL draft at some point comes under the microscope. Daniel Jones already under the microscope. What advice would you give those guys if they got to a point, in New York it's already there, where people are doubting and questioning whether they're going to be successful before they've had a chance to really get their arms around the league. From what you've experienced, what's the advice you would give those guys?
100%. It is, at the quarterback position and in the NFL in general, it is inevitable that you're going to be doubted. You're going to be doubted and be told you can't do something at one point in time. Even if you've been playing for 10 years and are a future Hall of Famer, that you still have people in the media writing future Hall of Famers off or saying that they're done or saying that this guy doesn't deserve that or what. So the number one thing I would tell these guys is you got to block it out. You got to just focus on the main thing, which is football and the people in your building. So block out all the media, all the naysayers, and anything that isn't positive in what you're trying to build within your team. So once you get with your team, the first thing you got to do is earn the respect of the people in your building. Everyone you come in contact with, learn their name, treat them with respect, treat them very, very well, and earn the respect of your teammates and your coaches through your work ethic and how much you care about the game and the organization you're now with. And once you get people bought into who you are as a person and they want to support you as a person, then you show them how you can play on the field. And then all it comes down to is how you perform and how you produce for your team and how you're handling those pressure situations. But I think if you just earn the respect of the people in your building, continue to stay true to yourself and to the game, usually it all takes care of itself if you just work hard and do the right things.
Mr. Trubisky, I'm a big believer in your business, even in my business, that no matter how talented you are, you have to be lucky and you have to work for good people and work with good people. For you, as a
Absolutely.
Quarterback, and I know they're both important, and you've had the good fortune of having both these things in spades, but if you could choose one, what's more important to a quarterback with talent being successful in the National Football League, your head coach or the guys you're throwing the football to, handing the football off to?
Ooh, I don't know if you're asking me to choose between those two. They're definitely so, so important, but if I had to label them 1A, 1B, I think even my coach would agree because he has no ego and he's selfless in it. Well, it is all about the players, and it's all about my teammates. So they deserve the credit for our team's success and even my success. They make me look good. My O-linemen, they give me time. They make the holes for the running backs. My receivers make the plays. And our coach is the one who orchestrate everything. So I think even Coach Nagy would agree that it's the players, but our head man, Coach Nagy, has deserved so much credit for all the success that we've had this last year and getting this thing turned around, and we're definitely all excited for the future. So that was a tough one.
Yeah, we got to throw one tough one at you. Mitchell Trubisky here on the show. Mitch, year three, different look to the offense a little bit. Some guys coming in, some guys going out. Jordan Howard, one of the guys who's gone. Bears go up and get David Montgomery out of Iowa State. They move up 15 spots to nab him. What do you expect this offense to look like? How do you expect it to operate maybe a little differently or improve from last season?
Yeah, definitely. I expect the offense to be a lot smoother, just better execution across the board. We're going to have a better plan of what we want this offense to be, what we think we're good at, and also what we need to improve on coming from last year. So everyone's bought into the plan. We're working really hard to everyone master their jobs, and we're going to get these new guys caught up on what they need to do. But at the end of the day, we want to have clean execution, but be even more explosive as offense. And that just comes down to executing your job and getting these amazing playmakers the ball. So we've got a great offensive line, and they make everything go up front. And we just got to get these awesome playmakers and all these guys we drafted and got throughout free agency. Just got to give them the ball in open space and let them roll. And if everyone does their job, we could be pretty special.
All right, Mitchell Trubisky, last question for you. I just moved from New York to L.A., and I'm trying to get healthier, right? And Gone Rogue, it's a product. It combines the crunchiness of a potato chip with the protein-rich benefits of jerky. All of those things I need. Can you tell us what you're doing with Gone Rogue?
Yeah, it's awesome. I've teamed up with Gone Rogue High Protein Chips, and it's really the best new snack out there. It's that crunchy, salty taste that you're craving in between meals that you need a snack on, but it's also very high in protein. So you got 17 grams of protein per bag. It's very healthy. They got all these awesome flavors. My favorite is barbecue right now. So it sounds like it's too good to be true, but it's actually amazing. The product is made from lean chicken. It's been smoked and then baked, and it's thinly sliced. So That's how it gets the crunchiness, and it's just that perfect snack in between. And it's been good for me training in the off season, getting that extra protein before or after workouts. And I'm very excited to be teamed up with them, especially since they're a Chicago company. So go ahead and get your Gone Rogue high protein chips on Amazon, and live that healthy lifestyle you want to, man.
Mitchell Trubisky, congrats on the success. Congrats on proving the doubters wrong. Thanks for hanging out here on the Jim Rome Show.
Thank you, man. Appreciate you having me.
Some breaking news this morning that made me sad for Jeannie Buss and the Los Angeles Lakers. And made me excited for the Phoenix Suns. Suns are a really interesting team with an interesting future. And if they land that number one overall pick and presumably roll in Zion Williamson, Monty Williams, the new head coach, has the opportunity to be pretty successful. But the reason this is a real problem for Los Angeles and why, for the first time in 3 or 4 years, I'm beginning to doubt one of my favorite people in the NBA and Jeannie Buss is because Monty getting the job in Phoenix means Ty Lue will be the head coach of the Los Angeles Lakers. And here's the reality about Ty Lue. Here's the truth about Ty Lue. When I was covering the NBA day in, day out, everybody knew, that before David Black coached a single regular season game in Cleveland, Ohio with LeBron James, he was already angling Ty Lue for that job, was already undermining his head coach. Whatever you think Ty Lue is on the floor, he's just a political animal who understands the value of sycophancy to LeBron James. And that's a pretty good place to be if you want to orbit his orbit a little bit. Because the people really in LeBron's orbit are actual friends. It's not bad if you're trying to produce a television show these days since LeBron's gotten into that business. Or if you want to get into the clubs a little earlier and you're the eighth guy on that roster. But as the head coach, one of the most important and promising and difficult jobs in professional sports is coaching LeBron James. Every ounce of opportunity is massive that comes with coaching him. Comes with some peril, too. Ask the coaches he's gotten fired. Ask Eric Spoelstra if you can get him in a private moment, who he tried to get fired. Rolling in someone whose primary job qualification is being obsequious to LeBron James is not success. And the reason that it's a problem for Jeannie Buss is because Jeannie has gone through nothing but a series and a process of mistakes since she really took the helm of the Lakers and fired her brother. I think Jeannie's smart. I think Jeannie, in a normal situation, could be a great owner because usually owners don't operate over a 2 or 3 year learning curve, but it can be decades. They own the team. But the fact is that in 2019, at a time where family-run businesses meet sports organizations don't work, the dirty little secret around the NBA is that the Lakers can't figure it out. There's a lot of doubt that the Buss family will own this team in the next generation, if not this generation. The infighting, the ugliness, the politics. Jeannie Buss hasn't been able to do the hardest thing there is to do when you have power and you have influence and you matter in sports. Think about how often we criticize LeBron James for his so-called hangers-on. Why can't he just see people for what they are? Why can't he just do the right thing? Well, you better apply the same level of criticism to the person that owns the team he plays for. Magic Johnson betrayed Jeannie Buss and left her on the lurch. She's going to tweet out photos about dinner last night? Are you kidding me? A report came out 2 days ago that Linda Rambis is the shadow owner of the NBA. You know why that's shocking? That it didn't come out sooner. Shadow owner of that Lakers team. She is. Because Jeannie turns to people that she trusts and turns to people that she knows. And I understand that. You understand that. But at a certain point, you have to stand on your own. Magic Johnson didn't care about Jeannie Buss except beyond what he could get from Jeannie Buss. And he left. You know why Rob Pelinka's the GM? A guy that is widely doubted in terms of his ability to be successful in Los Angeles. A guy who was such a cutthroat agent that other GMs don't want to deal with him around the National Basketball Association. You know why he has that job? Because he got Kobe Bryant way too much money his last couple years in Los Angeles. And now the rumors and the whispers that maybe Kurt Rambis could be the GM of the Lakers, that's Jeannie's best friend doing that whispering, and it's a problem. Jeannie Buss, and I've talked to her about this, wants nothing more than to live up to what her father passed on. Dr. Buss, I would argue the greatest owner probably in the history of professional sports. Didn't just create Showtime, but recalibrated the very particles of how we think about professional sports and entertainment and that merging. LeBron James and his whole acting, producing, greatness thing is the fulfillment of Dr. Buss's vision. And Jeannie may not be up to the task. And it pains me to say it, and I hope that I'm wrong. I said this on my show yesterday, Rider Than You, over on CBS Sports Radio, that if she hired Ty Lue, it was over. Because it would be clear she doesn't understand that you have to start trusting yourself. Not LeBron, not Magic, not Rob Pelinka, not your best friend. Best friends are great, but they're... The Godfather got it right. It's not personal. It's strictly business, and it hasn't been for Jeannie. Go and hire a general manager who wants to be a general manager. And let that person hire a head coach who wants to be more than LeBron James' yes man. Oh, LeBron, you want my parking spot at Staples? You can have it. LeBron, I'm really sorry that I drew up a play. You're right, my bad. That's not a recipe for success. And for LeBron James, who's already alienated from his locker room, and trust me, he is. You talk to sources around that Lakers organization. LeBron is neither feared nor loved in his own building. And bringing in a yes man's not going to change that for a moment. Jeannie Buss doesn't have that much time. And unless there's some kind of rabbit she's going to pull out of her hat, and I hope that she does, the Lakers' future and her ability to be the owner that I think she can be is over. LeBron, to quote a political story the other day, will eat your soul in small bites if you let him. Because the gravitational pull of everything that comes with him is overwhelming. I've been around it. I've seen it. You gotta, right or wrong, you gotta stay true to true north on your compass. And I'm not sure Jeannie has it.
Clones. If we had to sum up this talk show in a single word, it would come down to this: performance. And your life is probably the same way. You might have an important meeting, maybe a business trip. Maybe you're just fighting the afternoon crash. Sometimes you need that boost, but you want an alternative to coffee or sugary energy drinks. I've got that alternative. I've got that boost. I've got something to help take your game to the next level. It is called Dawn to Dusk. It's by Brickhouse Nutrition. Dawn to Dusk was designed to be a healthier, more effective alternative to typical energy supplements. With as little caffeine as a single cup of coffee, Dawn to Dusk provides up to 10 hours of clean energy. It heightens your focus. It improves your mood. And unlike coffee or energy drinks, there are no jitters or crash, just clean energy and focus with no calories and no sugar. Go to BrickhouseRome.com. Get 15% off your first order with the offer code ROME. 100% satisfaction guaranteed. So you've got nothing to lose here. Everything to gain. Go to BrickhouseRome.com. That's BrickhouseRome.com.
Portland Trailblazers general manager and all-around good dude, Neil Olshey. Neil, busy time, big game tonight. Thanks for making time.
Sure. Thanks for having me on.
You know, I'm curious, at this stage of things, are you able to enjoy these games? Are you able to enjoy what feels like, you know, a continuing but so far successful run? Or are there nerves still attached to just your viewing experience of the team you've put together?
No, it's still just relief or misery.
Neil Olshey on the program. Where were you? Can you set the scene? Can you describe for us where you were, what your reaction was when you watched, when you saw Damian Lillard bury that 37-footer to advance you guys into this series against Denver?
Well, yeah, you know, actually, I was in the back watching with my staff. You know, we had made our way down, you know, down toward the court, you know, as the game got closer. So, you know, we had everybody from, you know, PTs and video coordinators and support staff, and we kind of have a little lounge in the back with multiple televisions. And you know, unfortunately, we were about a two-second delay behind, so we actually knew the ball went through the hoop. But, you know, stealing that away, that moment away a little bit, you know, prematurely was well worth it.
I know the goal was obviously to be playing in June, to win a fourth game in the finals and to hoist that trophy. Do you let yourself, though, when you advance in that fashion? Are you hugging each other? Are you high-fiving? Are you trying to keep it cool? Like, what's the Neil Olshey reaction?
Yeah, no, I mean, look, I mean, it was a special moment for everybody. You know, I think there was a lot of, you know, exultation and relief as well. You know, we kind of probably unjustifiably were vilified last year because we happened to, you know, win 49 games and then get swept in the first round by a very good New Orleans team with, you know, two elite players that were having big series. And, you know, we had to live with, you know, the fallout of that, you know, through the entire off season and into the season. And everybody kind of, you know, there was this element of waiting for another shoe to drop. So, you know, so I really do. I think that, you know, it was very symbolic that it was Damian, you know, who's probably the most loyal, you know, player to the organization. You know, he's been here the longest. You know, we build our culture around him. And for that series, you know, against an elite opponent to culminate with, you know, with Dame making yet another buzzer-beating shot that, you know, will go down in the annals of NBA history, with everything that everybody had kind of, you know, gone through throughout the season and then the injuries we've suffered, you know, it was a special moment for everybody, from coaches to front office to our players and, you know, and most especially our fans.
Blazers GM Neil O'Shea here on the Jim Rome Show. Bill Ryder filling in. Jim, that Nuggets-Spurs series, it was just bizarre. It was a brain buster for me. Obviously, Nuggets advance in seven. How do you – what are your thoughts on the series so far, and particularly how your team is playing so far, these two games against Denver?
Well, you know, I mean, look, it is a series. You know, it's a series now, you know, because we won game two. You know, that was – it was critical, you know, for us not to come back down, you know, 0-2 and have to try and find a way to win four out of five games against, you know, a really good team, really well-coached team, well-constructed roster with a lot of talent. So I think we are in a series now, and, you know, things will continue to play out. You know, for us right now, our challenge is probably more health, you know, than anything else. You know, Ennis has been elite stepping in for Nurk, and, you know, now we've got Mo Harkless, you know, a little bit dinged up. And, you know, look, everybody's fighting through it at this point in the season. You know, it starts becoming a little bit of a war of attrition. You know, as much as everybody wants to, you know, point to adjustments, it's really about health and, you know, guys playing at their peak and maximum performance level. So, you know, so like, look, right now I think we've got, it's very interesting for us because they play a completely different style than we played in the first round. You know, Oklahoma plays very fast. You know, they get the ball up and down the court. You know, Denver, you know, from a pace standpoint is a little bit more methodical. You know, they play through Jokic quite a bit. You know, they're elite in the half court. They're an outstanding offensive rebounding team. You know, so like I said, it's a totally different opponent. There's very little reflective of the first series we could bring into the second series other than, you know, what we need to do on our end as far as bringing our best team, you know, and our best actions to the floor.
Neil O'Shea here on the show. You mentioned the injuries, and obviously the Nurkic injury, brutal for you guys, and you were able to get Kanter, what, I think a week, not quite a week after the Knicks waived him February 7th, which turned out to be a great move. Can you take us back to just your thinking, those moments, a guy like that becomes available? What's your process there in deciding and going after making sure that guy's a part of your team for what's turned out to be a pretty nice run so far?
Well, you know, traditionally, you know, we haven't been a destination for guys in the buyout market. You know, as a matter of fact, I was the one that proposed the initiative that we start looking at buyout reform because it did give an unfair advantage to teams, and it basically, you know, subordinated activity at the trade deadline as people kind of knew they could pick guys up, you know, after the fact. But, you know, we were lucky to be the beneficiaries of it this year, and I think, you know, really, you know, Bill, we've kind of taken a counterintuitive approach. You know, obviously we've got Dame and CJ, we've got an elite backcourt, but we really wanted to become more of a power team, you know, try to dominate the glass, be able to play inside out more. We can obviously do that with Nurk, you know, who, you know, is one of the top five centers in the league and was number two in the league in net rating at the center position league-wide prior to his injury. So we were able to do it there, but you know, Zach Collins and Myers Leonard play a different style, so it left a little bit of a void in terms of low post scoring for those other, you know, 14 to 20 minutes a game. So, you know, when Ennis became available, you know, I had given him the offer sheet that Oklahoma City had matched 4 years ago, a testament to the kid's character and loyalty that, you know, he chose us over multiple suitors. And more than anything, the key for us was, you know, whether we traded for Rodney Hood or we, you know, we signed Ennis Kanter was, we wanted to make sure we brought in guys that were seamlessly going to transition to our style of play and our culture. We didn't want to just go get a guy we were going to have to make a lot of adjustments for with only 25 games remaining and a team that was tracking toward 50 wins and home court advantage. So we really felt like Ennis replicated a lot of what Nurk's skill set is in terms of ability to score in the low post, offensive rebound. He's a very mobile big. He can run the floor. So, like I said, it's a testament to our coaches that, you know, they willingly accepted Ennis and he blended in seamlessly. I mean, I don't think, you know, anybody wanted, you know, his increased minutes and impact to come about the way that it did relative to Nurk's injury. But, you know, thank goodness for us, we had him there and we had a starting caliber center ready to step in and play 32 minutes a night in, you know, high pressure environments against, you know, guys that are elite players like Steven Adams and Nikola Jokic.
Bill Ryder filling in for Jim Rome here on CBS Sports Radio, talking to Blazers GM Neil O'Shea. Neil, I've told this story on the show that I host at night here on CBS Sports Radio a lot about I spotted you once at the Kansas City airport some January day when I lived there, miserable morning flight. You were coming in to scout someone at Kansas, someone at Kansas State, someone at Mizzou, wherever it was, and just the need for GMs to see with their own eyes the guys they might have a chance to draft and go after. When you were back scouting Lillard and you were back scouting McCollum, and obviously guys that very, very successful that some people looked past, what did you see that indicated they could be the players we've seen in this postseason?
Well, you know, it's a completely different model with Dame, I think, in terms of live scouting than it was with CJ. You know, as it turned out, Dame skyrocketed in the draft. But, you know, I was with the Clippers, you know, during Dame's senior, you know, his final season at Weber State. So, you know, when I was looking at Dame, it was kind of more of a due diligence thing initially. You know, with Damian, it really came down more his workout here, his interview with us, you know, the time we spent with him. You got a feel that he was the kind of player you could build an organization around. And, you know, and I joke about this all the time, Bill. You know, when you scout and you look at guys like Damian, it's to steal a Hollywood term, right? There are certain casting directors that 100 people walk into the room and, you know, one of them is George Clooney. And that casting director knows which one George Clooney is, right? Before George Clooney knows who he is. And I think that's the deal, right? Like, how do you spot a movie star? They just are movie stars. And, you know, I think we try to over-quantify things when it comes to scouting at times. And, you know, at the end of the day, you know, you watch, you evaluate, and then at some point there are these intangibles that you can't quantify that you just have to have a feel for and trust your gut. And, you know, and no one is more emblematic of that than Damian Lillard. With, you know, with CJ, you know, CJ was a little bit different. You know, we saw him play multiple times. You know, our East Coast scout saw him play a lot. And I was very fortunate that, you know, CJ was fighting through some injuries senior year, and I caught him on a snowy night between Christmas and New Year's. I drove down from the Newark airport to Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. They were playing Bryant College, and CJ had 34 and missed a floater at the buzzer to win the game, and it was the last game he basically played because he fractured his foot in the next game. So, you know, with CJ, it was, again, it was just seeing him, you know, watching how he played. You know, his style of play, we really felt like at some point our backcourt would be he and Damian together, that they were not a conflict with one another, but they complemented one another.
Neil O'Shea here on the show. Neil, as great as Lillard is, he has not been, at least offensively, as impressive this series. He hasn't been as efficient as we're accustomed to. How do they go after you guys when I think inevitably Damian Lillard offensively plays like Damian Lillard again?
I don't know. You know, I hope look, Mike Malone's a great coach, but I hope he doesn't figure it out until, you know, mid-May when we've moved on to play the winner of Golden State in Houston. But, you know, look, I mean, that's the playoffs, right? I mean, at some point, you know, all these playoff books and all the prep and what it becomes about players, not plays, right? As the series wear on, everybody knows everybody's sets. Everybody knows they're out of bounds plays. Everybody knows their coverages. And then it comes down to players making plays. And I think in this series, we've got elite playmakers on both sides. And it will come down at some point to, you know, who's getting it done on the court. Because there's only so many adjustments you can make. You can't add to your roster, right? Your rotations are your rotations. And, you know, with only one day between games, you're really using it to recover as quickly as possible, watch some film, and go out and play again. So, like I said, you know, the beauty of Damian Lillard for us is, and I learned this a long time ago, Bill, years ago, you know, when I was coaching with the Clippers with Mike Dunleavy, is one of the keys in this league is you want to have a guy on your roster that any night you walk into any gym, he can win you a game. And I think we all feel that way in Portland, is that no matter where we are, no matter who we're playing against, Damian gives us a chance.
Neil O'Shea here on the show. And with all that said, Jokic for Denver, and they've got some great players, but he's the guy. How do you, as best you can, how do the Blazers try and slow him down and make sure Jokic is not beating you guys, being that guy who steps on the floor and carries his team to a win?
Well, that's a question for Terry at media availability, because I can't talk about players on other teams. But I think we all, you know how great a player he is, and probably one of the top four or five greatest draft picks in terms of where they were drafted in the history of the NBA. So kudos to Tim Connelly and Arturis Karnishevis and their scouting staff, you know, for finding a guy like that in the second round.
Neil O'Shea, enjoy the ride. Congratulations. Good luck tonight. It's always a pleasure talking to you. Thanks for making time.
All right. Thanks for having me on.
Trapper in Medford, Oregon. What's going on, brother? You're on the Jim Rome Show.
Hey, how you doing, Bill?
I'm great.
I got to tell you, if we can't have Jimmy to talk today, we got royalty. So thank you for pinch hitting, my brother.
Thank you.
All right. Tomorrow, the biggest 2 minutes in sports. I got to talk a little bit about the Derby. And since this is a pony show, too, thanks to Jimmy. Well, tomorrow looks like we have the Bob Baffert Stakes at Churchill Downs, coming off last year's Triple Crown win with Justify. He's got three faves going into the race, otherwise known as the Kentucky Derby. I think after Omaha Beach's scratch, the new fave is going to be Baffert's game winner. He's going to go off around somewhere between 5-1 and 9-2. He was first in the Breeders' Cup Juvenile last year, which made his bones, although he did lose to Roadster in the Santa Anita Derby. He's in the 16 hole, but he's got a cumber. He's a come-from-behind specialist. You give up nothing breaking from a long stretch with Joel Rosario. If he's on his mark, he's going to be tough to beat. Yeah, next you have another Baffert fave in Roadster going off somewhere around 5-1. As I said, he won the Santa Anita Derby, where thankfully no horse had to be put down. Sidebar, Mike Smith, one of the classiest guys in the jockey room, Bill. He jumped off Roadster, as we all know, to Mount Omaha Beach, which has since been scratched, leaving, I guess, last year's Triple Crown jock without a mount. To his credit, Bob Baffert is going to stand pat on leaving Flo Giroux. One Roadster, call it poetic justice or just plain crap luck, but it sucks for you, Mike Smith. Last then, you have Don't Hold Your Breath, Improbable, another Baffert colt and favorite. He's going to go off somewhere like the others, around 5-1. He's an early speed colt. He has a good number 5 in the post, which gives him something to work with. And so which Baffert horse do I pick to win Where the Roses on Saturday? Nah, can't do it. I've never been a chalk guy, and this Derby's no different. I'm going with Tacitus, coming in somewhere around 10-1 tomorrow, but I think that'll drop. I loved his run in the Wood Memorial, coming from deep in the back stretch. Looked like bumper cars at Palisades Park back there, to quote the great Jerry Eisenberg from Jersey. He also won the Tampa Bay Derby, and you know I have some fondness in my heart, as the clones know, for Tampa Bay. And yeah, Silk, it stays here. Trainer Bill Mott is an all-time great. Jose Ortiz will be sporting the Garland of Roses when it's over. And last, so, Ray, I know you're going to swing in today, and you're going to probably jump on one of the Baffert sweethearts. Say it ain't so, Joe. Much love to all of the people out there in the jungle that have been so supportive of me and a battle that's going on. I got my mouthpiece in. I'm in the center of the ring, and I'll make the bell for the 12th. God bless you all. Billy, great job. Tramps like us, babe. I'm out.
Trapper, thank you, brother.
Good night!